So I'm looking for some alumni of U of H or Rice or Texas A&M to come in the door, because your three women's college soccer coaches are here, and these guys are all successful in their own right. We've got from U of H, Diego Bocanegra. We have Brian Lee from Rice, and we have G. Guerreri from Texas A&M. Starting with you, G, thank you guys for coming out here tonight. I think this is a nice, rare moment to get three college coaches here like this.
No, you bet. It's great to be here, and again, three friends as well, so it's good. Always good to get together.
So let's just start it off with this. I just want to kind of recap each of your program seasons, because you all had very, very good seasons. I'll start with you, Diego. You guys ended up 6-4-1. You had a number of games shortened by the pandemic, but this is the first winning season since 2010. You really feel like you're turning the corner and building something with your program.
Absolutely. Anytime we can end up on the better side of things, even with those four losses, three of them 1-0 on the road, two of them in overtime, we felt like we were really close. But I was proud of our women this year, dealing with the pandemic, dealing with everything. Only graduating two seniors, feel like the future's pretty bright.
Yeah, and a lot of your recruiting in the state of Texas, is that where it takes place?
You know, we recruit nationally. About half our team is from Texas, but I feel like recruiting against these two who have a little bit more established programs than other people in the state, we've got to look outside the state, but we want to try to keep some of our talent home as well.
We're glad you're here tonight. Thank you so much. U of H Women's Cougars head coach Diego Bocanegra. Let's go to Rice. Credible season this year, 14-3-1 NCAA tournament, knock off Furman, knock off West Virginia, go down to Virginia. Great program. Brian Lee, I know him from days in the SEC with LSU. Brian, congratulations on a great season. Just enlighten us a little bit about your program that had such a successful season.
Thanks. When we got here from LSU, we thought it was a program that could be relevant nationally, but we did think it would take 4 or 5 years. We feel like we've got a demographic that really plays with women's soccer from a recruiting standpoint, and to do that well that quickly is a real testament to our players and everybody involved over at Rice.
G. Guerreri, well, we know G from a long time, basically started the program at A&M, 12-4-1. You were 7-1 in the SEC. You knocked off USF. You knocked off Oklahoma State in penalties dramatically. Went down to North Carolina 1-0, but you were in the NCAA tournament as well. Gee, 26 years. It's hard to believe. I'm sitting across here looking at you, having known you from so far back. Future's bright. You look young. Program continues to do great things.
Yeah, like I said, I'm the luckiest guy you know. We had another good year on a year where, you know, everything could have gone wrong. I was real pleased with the way that our players hung in there. You know, they didn't. A lot of places didn't play in the fall. These guys didn't get a chance to play their seasons in the fall. And the SEC was one of them that said, hey, we need to try to find a way to make this work, and spent a lot of money to make sure that we were, we had stuff up our noses, you know, testing us three times a week. And but the girls really, really stood firm. It was great to see how these young people were able to kind of circle their arms and come together. And for us, it was great. You know, we won the SEC again, which was our 18th conference championship, and then, like you said, our 26th straight trip to the NCAAs, and our 7th trip to the Elite Eight. And we returned 10 starters for next year, so we think we're going to be pretty good.
Yeah, that's not a bad thing. All right, so let's switch gears a little bit. Let's get you guys into the Euros. First of all, Brian, how much have you been watching? Are you like me? Are you in front of the TV constantly here and trying to find a life at some point?
A decent bit. We're running our camps out at Rice, so I'm back and forth, sweating, trying to hide from camp a little bit, you know, when it's roasting out. But it's been awesome. You know, I think the coverage in the U.S. has come so far. And it's so much fun, especially when the games flip to during the day. It's fantastic respite.
Anything jump out to you in the Euros so far, specifically to you?
You know, for me, the humanity of the Eriksson situation, to see the soccer world come together is just absolutely wonderful. And to see them come through in a clutch game to make the round of 16 that gives everybody an underdog to cheer for. And the Euros are a different tournament than the World Cup. You know, Greece, Iceland, teams are going to make a splash in a little smaller teams. So gives everybody someone to cheer for.
Diego, how about you?
Yeah, I'm a little bit different. I'm addicted. I record every game. I'm a soccer nut. I was just talking to these guys. watched a replay of the Denmark game and everything with my family yesterday and my 9-year-old son. And he's like, I had watched it live. And he's like, what's going to happen, Dad? Oh, is he going to save the penalty? No, they need to score. It was great. I've been really impressed with the Italian side. They defend like traditional Italian teams, yet they got their front foot on the gas and they're going for it. They're attacking. The group of death has been fun to watch. You know, I wasn't sure about Germany, and then after that result against France, they come around and do what they did to Portugal. It's been a blast.
Yeah, and tomorrow we got Sweden, Poland, Slovakia, Spain, Portugal, France, Germany, and Hungary. So some very, very big games tomorrow. That Portugal-France game, that's one I'm definitely not missing. How about you, G? What jumps out to you in the Euros?
Well, I think it's interesting to see the contrast between the Euros and Copa America both going on at the same time, and the Euros having obviously different places in Europe, but having live fans and the energy that comes from that. Also, the production value of what is going on in Europe compared to what frankly looks like a third world tournament in Brazil. And again, those guys don't like each other in South America, so there's going to be that hard edge to the way the game's going on. But it just doesn't seem the same with seeing, you know, tarps over the seats. And I've been enthused by the fact that soccer is on everywhere and that it's easy to find, and that, you know, and then just walking down the street or driving down the street, how much you see of international football, whether you see a Finland jersey or you see a Chelsea jersey, you see anything else, just how much it's grown is really refreshing. It makes us feel like we're a little more part of society now that the game has become a little bit more popular.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up the stark contrast between the Copa America and the Euros, because some people were talking to me and just saying, wow, I can't watch it, there are no fans. I'm like, look, that's the reality of the world right now in Brazil, right? We've had a ton of players test positive for COVID. It is what it is. But to your point, the lack of naturalized players on, you know, the Colombias,
right,
and all these countries that are so defined makes for, you know, a little different sort of dynamic when they get
your
together.
Your great-grandfather did this to my great-grandfather, and we're going to get you for it.
Exactly. So that is pretty amazing. Speaking of television, I mean, think about the college game now. Now, how, you know, all your games are pretty much people are able to watch. It is pretty remarkable. I mean, that's, you know, Brian talked about that because, you know, whether it's ESPN Plus or your own productions, I mean, you're going to recruits and saying, look, our games are on television.
Yeah, the mainstreaming of college soccer to the disposable ability to watch it with quality production. Now, the announcers are good. The picture quality is good. It's come so far so fast. It's a super exciting time to be involved.
And, gee, I got to think, helps with recruiting, and it also
it
helps with scouting opponents like Rice and U of H.
Well, it really does. And then the other thing that has come along that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't see is that there's so much more data and information that is available because so many games are accessible by television. So we all use a product called Instat, which is a kind of a national clearinghouse for games for college games. And so I've asked these. It's a Russian company, I think, and I've asked Boris, who my rep, where they get the games, and he's like, you don't want to know. So, which makes me think they could fix an election if they wanted to. But it's that's been, again, the world has gotten smaller, the country has gotten smaller, and it's made it to where the sharing of ideas, the information, and really opening the eyes of different parts of the country to what's going on here in Texas is kind of cool.
G. Guerreri, Texas A&M, Brian Lee Rice, Diego Bocanegra is here as well with the University of Houston. We got three college coaches in-house, 7620 Katy Freeway. It is Hugh O'Connor's Pub. Come on out. Join us right now. You can meet the coaches of these programs. They're doing tremendous work. And at the end of the day, Diego, it is still about mentoring young people, isn't it?
100%. That's why most of us got into the job. And if we didn't get into that, that's where we grow into. It's about our players. It's about everyone. And we just love being able to share our life lessons through the sport that we love.
Yeah. Brian, could you just add to that at all?
Yeah, you know, especially when you get with college-age kids. It's just a fantastic experience. Everyone always talks about in the coaching community where you want to coach, pro, college, men, women, and the ability to impact young people at a crucial age, you know, for us, it's fantastic.
So you guys, and any of you jump in here, and don't be afraid to talk to each other because we can make this conversational as well. But the other thing is just thinking about it from the perspective of, you know, I'm looking at how the game has grown at the youth level and the quality of instruction, the coaching, the fields, the infrastructure, the amount of money that's changing hands. How many of the ladies that you talk to when you recruit them are saying to you, hey, I want to play in the NWSL. I want to go pro. Is it a large percentage of your recruits that say, look, my career, I don't want to end in college. I'm at a rare area as it is right now, but I want to go one more step. I want to go into the NWSL and try and make a career of this.
Yeah, I think this happens a lot more than it used to, even 5-6 years ago. And I credit that to just the country, the NWSL, U.S. Soccer, ESPN, everyone that just gives us a platform. Because the more that these girls can see young women aspiring to realize their dreams on a national and international level, if you see it, you can believe it. And now that it's more visible, it's great, because when you find those recruits and you find those players, you know that they're intrinsically motivated. You don't have to push those buttons. Now it's just our job to help them along their pathway. Okay, this is what you want to do. I can help you get there. It's going to take a lot of hard work, but we can do that. And yes, it's much more prevalent than it's ever been, in my opinion.
Well, and what I find awesome about it is now it's not just the NWSL. They're looking at, you got 16-year-olds looking at Man City, and they're looking at Barcelona to go play for the women's team. And the connection between the men and women across the world, especially in Europe, has changed so much in the last 2-3 years. If you pop over now, Man City's women's academy looks just like their men's academy. It's an awesome experience for a youth player. And if you go to Etihad, there's huge banners dropping down of the women's team just like the men's team, which 10 years ago, non-existent. You could take Barcelona. Women weren't playing 10 years ago. You could find some obscure club was the best teams in Spain. But now all of the major clubs have adopted gender equality, I guess is the best way to describe it. And now our young kids, a 15-year-old in Houston, can aspire to play for Man City women the same way a young boy does aspiring to play for the Man City men.
G, draw a line to that, because you've had a number of international players as well.
Right. Well, players have gone on to play international. We've had a pretty small number of internationals who have come here to play. But I can tell you that every single kid that I'm talking to right now, every single one of them hopes to play beyond college. And what we found is that those are the kids actually that are the better players when they become juniors and seniors, because the end of their rainbow isn't, you know, at the end of their senior year, that they're wanting to do whatever they can to put themselves onto a platform that's going to help them to make that springboard to, whether it's here in the league in the United States or whether it's, you know, Iceland or anywhere. I mean, it could be, you know, right now they're playing on every continent. Women's professional soccer is being played on every, except for Antarctica, every continent out there. And it's phenomenal how much it's gone that way. And again, money is of course the key. Mexico is a great example. You know, when Mexico said, you know, you're not going to be in leave it in the men's first division unless you have a women's side, boom, the huge, you know, shot in the arm that is to women's soccer. Now initially the league is going to struggle because they're trying to put all these new players into the league, but I think that the Mexican national team is going to be one of the huge beneficiaries of that type of thinking. And the same thing is going on so many different places around the world. It's really, really fun to watch.
Do you guys see the gap narrowing with the U.S. women's national team? Do you see it narrowing with specific – I mean, obviously the Netherlands and countries with a deep soccer culture, but maybe give us an example of something that really pops to you when it comes to – a country that, wow, you know, they've really been impacted from what the U.S. women's national team has done.
I think the Dutch is a good example of it. I mean, my team beat the Dutch national team in 2000. It ain't even close if we go back over there right now. And that's just because of the culture has come around, whether it's you know, in Latin countries with, you know, machismo or anything else that was holding these women back. Well, now just the acceptance, social acceptance of these women to be competitive athletes is refreshing.
Yeah, and I think all of us were here probably going, okay, well, if the Netherlands decides to get into the women's game, or if, you know, Brazil decides to get heavy into the women's game, which they were one of the earlier ones, but you know what I'm saying.
France,
right?
And Germany.
There's nothing going to stop them. Thank you.
Yeah,
exactly,
so,
Diego.
So, yeah, the way I look at it, too, is you see, like Brian was alluding to earlier, the top French clubs spend their money. You know, when I was at Notre Dame before I got to Houston, we went over there and we played PSG, and it's not the same even 5 years ago when we went over there. But what G was talking about in Mexico, I see similar to what happened here. When Major League Soccer really started taking off, it helped the U.S. a little bit, but it really helped the Central American countries, Honduras, Guatemala, all those countries benefited their national teams hugely. They had a major impact because their players are coming here and playing in an organized professional league at a higher level than they were before. And like you're saying, I have former players that are playing in Mexico. And that league is set to take off in the next three to 5 years, I believe. And then we're going to have our southern neighbors be a true adversary. You know, Canada's always been right there. And what they do with their youth programs, we've got to keep an eye on, because what the Vancouver Whitecaps and some of the other clubs in Canada are doing, we've got to keep our foot on the gas, or else, yes, that gap is going to start to shrink.
And it would be great if that happened now, with MLS clubs being more proactive in starting it. Of course, the Dynamo and the Dash is a unique commodity, but I mean, there's no reason why FC Dallas and the new Austin club shouldn't be doing the same thing. They can field great teams with some homegrown players and then sprinkle in others. So, you know, you hear rumors of MLS, you know, potentially starting or going in cahoots with NWSL. And, you know, initially it's going to water down the league a little bit, because you've got to develop those players. But something like that is if that can happen, it can be just the next big step that can really help not just our women's national team, but, you know, the game in general with kids.
G. Guerrero, Brian Lee, Rice, G. Guerrero, Texas A&M, Diego Bocanegra, U of H, joining us here live at Hugh O'Connor's 7620 KD Freeway. Hugh O'Connor's Pub, by the way, official home of Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5. They're showing all the Euro games. They're showing Copa America. Come on in, join us. When we come back, we're going to talk about the NWSL with these three gentlemen. And we're going to talk about a little bit about how the product can become the NWSL product deeper in the consciousness and more relevant from both fan attendance and some of those things. And I'm interested to get all of your guys' thoughts on this. All right, we're out at Hugh O'Connor's Pub, Katy Freeway, 7620. Show is, as always, presented by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. A big thank you to John and his firm. They're personal injury attorneys. DaspitLaw.com in Houston, DaspitLawAustin.com in Austin, Texas. We'll take a break. We get more to come.
Quick shot, score! The U.S. with Dempsey! Turn it up!
Fabregas, who looks for Iniesta, who's onside! Spain score!
Entonces el centro de Madrid.
Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. Live from Hugh O'Connor's Irish Bar and Restaurant, here's Glenn Davis.
It's Hugh O'Connor's Pub, 7620 Katy Freeway, and our good friend Andrew Kapalski of the Snowdrop Foundation is in the house here. Andrew, thank you for being here. Reminder about Snowdrop Foundation, 501c charity. Probably know that I'm very involved with pediatric cancer awareness and fundraising. This is what the Snowdrop Foundation does. This is what Andrew does. So it's all about cancer awareness. We do dinners. Andrew does these wonderful, very intimate dinners with broadcasters and athletes and ex-boxers. We also do a big soccer dinner, which we need to, we need U of H, Rice, and A&M down there. Tom Clare does these dinners. We've had Norman Whiteside come in and speak. We've had Brian McClare. A lot of legendary Manchester United players, so we'll hope to get you guys down there this year. But it's all for pediatric cancer awareness and fundraising. It's snowdropfoundation.org. It's a 501c charity. And the main thing they do, though, is provide scholarships for kids that have had pediatric cancer, are being treated, or are cancer survivors. So that's the other beautiful thing it does. And if you remember, Trish and Kevin Klein spearheaded it. Gene's spearheading it now. But guys like Andrew Kapalski do a lot of the heavy lifting, and nobody really knows that. So they do now, Andrew. You're screwed. I'm just kidding you. You're in trouble now. All right, so that's snowdropfoundation.org, and a big thank you to that. Okay, we have live in here G. Guerreri, Texas A&M. We have Brian Lee of Rice, and we have Diego Bocanegra of U of H. So I'm just going to put it out there to you. How do we make the NWSL more relevant? How do we get more fans into games? How do we get bigger crowds? Because, look, if we're being honest, historically, women's team sports has not drawn at the professional level. Except the Olympics, you could start with money.
The investment. There's just been too much hesitancy in putting money into it to do it the right way. And you know, for a lot of the players who go into the league after being at major universities like any of us, you know, it's a step down to the way that they're treated in a lot of the places in the league. And it's only been recently that things have started to pick up. I know, with James Clarkson coming in here and taking over as the head coach for the Dash, I think it's been a really good thing for the women in that program, because he's been in the organization for a while, so he has more credibility to what he's asking for. But I think if you were to ask him, it's like, if we want to be really seen as a professional outfit, then we've got to be a professional outfit. We've got to put a little bit more money into it and not have our players traveling around the country in middle seats.
Gents?
Yeah. For me, that's a big step. But I think it's exposure as well. Why does everyone love the Olympics? One of the things that I think we do in this country very well is we tell the story. We tell the story of the person, not just the soccer player, the basketball player, the track athlete, whatever it may be. And when you start telling stories, then people become interested in the human factor. And I don't think we do that very well on the women's side. I don't think they get the same media exposure. I don't think there's some amazing stories from some of these women and some of the things that they had to go through just to get to where they are. And yes, those same stories are told on the men's side, but I don't think they're told on the women's
side. But to that point, aren't the clubs and the teams also responsible 100%, for getting out there and telling the story
100%.
And creating relationships with local media?
100%. I agree.
Yeah, and that's true. Right. And believe me, having interviewed the women and called U.S. Women's National Team games, they're some of the best salespeople going.
Oh,
okay,
it's unbelievable.
They're tremendous.
I mean, they've pulled the game up by their own bootstraps, is right. What they've done.
Well, and to me, it's a combination of the two. The women's game on TV looks just like the men's game. It's a great replication. If you watch a WNBA, it does not look like an NBA game. But women's soccer, high-level women's soccer on TV looks very similar to high-level men's soccer. If you can combine that with the right ownership groups, does anyone think Arthur Blank's not killing it if he has a women's team in Atlanta? There's no way. It would be packed crowds. It would be supported in the city, and Arthur would put his means behind it. It's just getting that right combination of marketing, TV coverage, plus the right ownership groups. And it'll blow up.
Why do you think they're hesitant, Brian? That would be my next obvious question.
Well, I don't think it's a slam dunk financially. I think if everyone could go way back 25 years ago, whenever MLS started, you'd have every major investor in the country lining up to say, I want some of that on the men's side.
$3 million to get in the early three. I think the Crafts got in at $3 million.
And they had three owners, period.
Unbelievable business product. And I think the women's can be the same with the right ownership. You see it in Europe now, what you're seeing at Man City, what you're seeing at Barcelona on the women's side. In Mexico, what you're seeing at Tigres on the women's side.
Yep.
It's just ownership and marketing. If they do it right and if they get after it, it's going to work because the TV product is good. It's like the NFL. NFL is a perfect sport for TV. It's not the perfect sport to go watch as a fan. It's perfect for TV, which is where so much of the money and the marketing is generated from. So we just need that right group of owners to take that leap.
And if you take the emotion out of it, if you really just think from a pure business standpoint, if you're an MLS owner or if you have this, every day that your stadium sits empty is lost revenue. You have these facilities built already. You have this. You don't need the same full capacity, everything to start. But pure economics, you're cutting your fan base in half if you're only catering to the men. These young girls want to look up to somebody.
Well, and I think they're cutting it in half again when these clubs are putting their name and their jerseys on opponents of the kids who play in the town. So Dynamo are an example of that. You know, you've got Dynamo Dash Youth, which is a big, great organization, but it comes across as that, you know, they're the enemy of my team. You know, my blue team or my red team or my green team, we got to play against the Dynamo Dash. So why am I going to go and support them when they kicked my daughter last week? So I think that, you know, a few of the other markets have done a good job of getting it to where everyone's on board to support. And I think Austin is doing this right now. They're not Lone Star. They are their own entity. And the two big clubs in Austin are both trying to be part of what's going on and saying, hey, we want to be on your team. And yeah, we don't have to be competitors, but we want to help you. And I think you can look at the early success and the passion that's going on just in Travis County and Williamson County.
Yeah, that was the problem with the Dynamo's entry into the youth community in the beginning.
FC Dallas
too divisive, and there's a lot of suturing that needs to be done and repair work that has to be done, and a lot of times
because there's a lot of great
not easy
people.
To retract and go back on.
There are so many good in this community. There are so many good people who want to see the game succeed, but if they feel like that's their opponent, then you're kind of cutting your own throat. And I know the economics of youth soccer can be beneficial for some of these people, but, you know, can we find a way that everyone's on the same team and working in the same direction?
Yeah, that's I think some clubs have been better at that than others, honestly.
Of course.
Just being at the top of the pyramid, extending the olive branch, making sure they're trying to help everybody and kind of make it a one-for-all, all-for-one attitude, easier said than done. But like you said, they are doing that in Austin. I don't think there's any question. Anything else on that front?
I want to just add to that is, like what you're saying, you look at LAFC, you look at Atlanta United on the boys' side, on the men's side, and from personal knowledge, I know that Atlanta United, exactly what you're saying, they didn't want to take over a club, align with one club. They wanted to align with the community. LAFC did the same thing. I grew up in Southern California. I have a lot of friends that coach club there, and you know they went to the local clubs, and they said, look, here's what we're doing. We want to compensate you, benefit. Yes, some of your players, they're probably going to leave and go to us anyway. So why not align with us? And some of our players that aren't making it here, we're going to send them your way. And it becomes a two-way street, and it becomes mutually beneficial. That's what you have to do.
Yeah, nobody's going to lose people to coach and
exactly.
kids to coach.
Exactly.
I mean, just if you want to be a part of the process. And, you know, look what happened with the center back, Chris Richards, right? Was here, and Eric Quill finds him in Alabama, brings him to Houston. He's with the Texan Soccer Club, realizes very quickly that this kid's finding it way too easy playing youth soccer. Okay, I got to take him either to the Dynamo or FC Dallas. Sends him to FC Dallas. Now the kid's, you know, at Bayern Munich, has been out on loan in the Bundesliga. And, you know, those are the kind of decisions
that should be easy for
a youth coach.
And
it
we can't speak for Eric. Eric did a great job when he was here with Texans. But I wonder how much of his decision, again, open-ended, why did he go to FC Dallas instead of going to the Dynamo?
Because the Dynamo was... Because he liked the FC Dallas program at the time better than the Dynamo
one. And the Dynamo program is in his backyard and their opponents. And so... It just makes it a little bit easier to send them up there. And, of course, the FC Dallas program is a great program. Don't get me wrong. But it just would be nice if we could all get out of each other's way and all go in the same direction, all swim in the same direction.
It's tough, though, when there's so much money at stake.
And,
of course. You know, people's livelihoods are threatened. There's all these other things going on. All right, so here's the one I asked Lisa Baird today of the NWSL, and I always ask this question because I do not have the answer to it, and I think you guys could probably shed some light on this to me. When I look at the NWSL and I look at all the women in this country that started as kids in youth soccer, got dragged all around the country by their parents, playing games, training all week long. Some of them go on to very good college careers. A few of them go on to NWSL careers. And then I look at the women that come to games. And I don't see that crowd that now are wives, are in high-profile jobs. Why aren't they supporting the NWSL in bigger numbers? I mean, it's almost like soccer was a participatory sport to them, and they didn't like it any deeper rooted. I don't understand that. And so many women I ask that are family people or you know, holding down tremendous jobs, doing tremendous work in the community, whatever, they tell me, oh, I'd rather watch the guys.
Yeah, I think it's a great point that starts with the whole reason for Title IX. So Title IX really started being affected in the, what was it, the early 90s?
79 was when it was enacted.
But well, enacted.
People started following the rules in the 90s.
In the 90s. So it's a generational thing to me. It's like soccer in the United States as a whole. You know, you got to get generational support before you can really, you know, get the financial backing and have the right people get in the right places. And it's got to become such a generational thing. And it takes literally generations to do that. So the first group of soccer moms were playing participation soccer, for sure. There wasn't even college soccer. Now the second phase, about as sophomores in high school realized, wait a second, someone will pay me to go to college in the year 2005 that I can get a scholarship and go play. This is great. Free money. I'll go do it. But it was still just a hobby. They just happened to be the right age. Now we're starting to get into the age groups where their mom also had those opportunities, and it became a serious sport. You know, and that's the whole reason behind gender equity in Title IX. But it does take decades, and it takes generations. And, you know, bigger picture societal, that they also have to have high-profile jobs, and you got to be CEOs of companies, and they've got to be partners at the law firms, you know, and things like that, where they can really support, whether it's college programs or pro soccer, and eventually have female owners. It's no different than the minority development. I don't know who the first African-American owner of an NBA team, but it wasn't that long ago, you know. So we're following that same path. So it is going to take time to have that kind of backing behind it, which is just societal.
But what about all your players? Are they players that you guys think one day when they get out into the business world, they become parents, are they going to be people that buy season tickets to go watch the NWSL?
I think yes, and the reason I say that is they grew up watching the NWSL, whether it was forced to because we show them video clips in the locker room and, okay, this is what the best looks like, here's what it is. But, again, they were able to see it, and what Brian's talking about is, okay, this generation that's not buying tickets right now, they never knew that it existed. They never watched it because the NWSL wasn't around when they were coming up through. Now that they're seeing it, it takes time. And I think I see a lot more of those players in this generation. They come back to college games more than they do the NWSL because they have that affiliation. And now, you know, my kids growing up here in Houston, they have that affiliation with the Dash and the Dynamo, and they have players to look up to, and that's those memories that you don't forget. I grew up in L.A. I still remember watching Fernando Valenzuela pitch because I'm a Mexican-American, grew up in L.A., in his prime. I'm a Dodger fan for life for that simple reason. I had somebody to look up to.
Don't say that too loud here.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
But you get what I'm saying.
By the way, they stole that team from Brooklyn anyway.
Well, and for how long were we America's Next Great Sport as a men's side?
Long time.
You know, we're growing up as kids, and it's in the NASL.
Remember Project 2020?
Oh, yeah, Project 2020. It's awesome. Yeah.
What year is it now? 2021. I guess we didn't win the World Cup. But we're getting close.
Maybe that next generation is coming.
Well, this generation now. We'll talk about that in a minute. But what are your relations? Okay, that's music that tells me we've got to go to break here. We're having so much fun. I don't even know what I'm doing. We're going to take a break here. Soccer Matters ESPN 97.5 out at Hugh O'Connor's Pub. 7620 Katy Freeway, in the house, live and in person. G. Guerrero, Texas A&M, Brian Lee Rice, Diego Bocanegra, U of H. Give them a round of applause for making the effort to come out here. We appreciate it, guys. Very nice of you to do it. We'll take a break here. Show is always brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. DaspitLaw.com. We'll take a break. More with these three gentlemen next.
ESPN 97.5.
Hi, this is Adam Lundquist from the Houston Dynamo, and thank you for listening to Soccer Matters with Glenn Davis.
All right, a big thank you to Adam Lundquist. He's played for Sweden. By the way, Dynamo Portland tomorrow, Channel 55. You can also catch it on ESPN+. Eddie Robinson, myself, Cindy Bourbano will have the call from BBVA Stadium. Six of the next nine on the road for the Houston Dynamo. I would expect, based on the fact that these teams have played on Saturday, there should be some lineup changes for both the Dynamo and Portland. Portland is welcoming back Sebastian Blanco off an ACL injury. But the Dynamo need this one at home with six of the next nine on the road. That's tough stuff. Need support for Fafa Pico and Maxi Arruti up front. So, you see, that's a big one for the Dynamo and Tom Ramos tomorrow night. By the way, Jan Christensen in the house. Jan, raise your hand, please, here at Hugh O'Connor's. If you are in the market for modern contemporary furniture, he's also a sponsor of the show. Just got back from Copenhagen. Jan, thank you for coming out. We'll have you on the show next week.
He's got his Ericsson jersey on. Yeah, that's good.
He
love
does.
It.
He does. He's one of the greats. All right, so let's get back with G. Guerrero, Brian Lee, Diego Bocanegra.
Well, you know, you were talking about, you know, what does it take to grow the support of for women to support, you know, the women's game. And, you know, these guys are talking about how it takes time, and it really does. And I think our program in College Station is a pretty good example of it. I mean, we lead the nation in attendance because of the year after year after year and the investment that the local community makes in the game. They see the value. And they know the stories. They know what the players are like. They know what the players come from. And it's a reasonable price, too.
Let me stop you for a second. You do a great job of nurturing that as well.
Well,
you got a university that has backed you, has grown to back you.
Well,
you have educated them as well.
But that's the support.
I guarantee you've gone into athletic directors' offices and had some...
Yeah, I'm a pain in the neck is the way it works.
You fought for the game.
But that's what we're saying is at the next level where, you know, a season ticket is not the cost of what it is for a college season ticket in a college town. Just going out and make for the fans, for the locals to feel an ownership in what's going on. And I think, and again, I think the Dash are on the right track of getting that done. It's tough that they play in such a big empty stadium. I don't think that helps them that much.
I always thought they should go down to the rugby field.
I agree.
Down there. I think it would be more intimate.
It's not that we want the rugby team to go out of business,
no.
But if someone would just play more games down there, it would be great.
Share the dates. By the way, the Houston Dash will play Orlando on Saturday. And when we're done with this break, we're going to give some tickets away to the Gold Cup. We're going to give some Dash tickets away. We're going to give some Dynamo tickets away as well. So some people are going to walk out of here being able to go to games. So what's your relationship? I mean, I know you guys all know James. I know you've been involved. I know you guys have all been involved with him. But what more can be done to tie in Rice, to tie in A&M, to tie in U of H with the Dash in the NWSL program? Is that a fair question?
I think it is. I mean,
I think it's a great question. I think James is super approachable and has we've got a great relationship with him. And in terms of a partner of Rice University, I can't imagine a headliner of a club doing any more than he does. You know, the collaboration piece, really, they have the players. They got the staff in place. They've got the what the people in the core spots want to do. It's just a marketing piece, and how do we get more people at the games and get collaborative support? And I think she's really onto something with the youth side of things, with the whole Dash Dynamo concept. You're not going to get a 12-year-old from Albion to come out to Dash Dynamo or have their parents buy season tickets. because they are competing with them on Saturday,
but that's
Sunday.
That's the way they elected to go into it now. That's a hard thing to retract and change. Nope. I mean, there's no question. That, and then you could go deeper into that. That is a difficult thing to change. Let me ask you guys a question. Could there ever be a – could we ever develop something inner city with your three programs and maybe add HBU into it and showcase the college game at BBVA Stadium? Try to create an event that showcases the college game a little bit more, because I don't think we do enough. I personally don't do enough on this show with it. I should be. But, you know, there's only so much you can pack into 2 hours. And I'm just thinking there has to be something, if we put our heads together, we could do as far as a tournament, try to get the blessings from the Dynamo. And I think it could be a win-win for everybody. And promoting the college game, you guys have spent your entire lives working at the women's game and being not only coaches but proponents of the sport and the quality of the women's game. Why not?
Yeah, I love the idea. I mean, for me, what I think it is some sort of city league, cup type thing that's within the college season. And the idea you've had with having the Dash support at the end of it, I think would be fantastic.
Yeah, we've talked about doing this in the past. It's just a matter of scheduling and getting things done, and of course the pro teams wanting that to happen. I mean, are we a pain in the neck or are we a benefit?
And why would you guys be a pain in the neck?
Well, there's a lot
you're
of moving
growing
parts.
The women's, yeah, but you're growing the women's game like they are. You guys are only assets to me. And it could be players one day coming from your program.
Well, especially with these guys being in town, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. And same thing with Houston Baptist. It makes all the sense in the world with them playing games and doing stuff. It's a little bit more difficult for us. I mean,
there's a lot of Aggies in town, G.
I know, and we draw more than the
They're
Dash
everywhere.
Right now.
I'm kind of wishing I went to A&M at some point. I need a good support system.
Well, is there anything more similar than the English league system than college football? If you take a Texas A&M supporter, they don't care what they're playing.
Right. Ping pong.
It could be ping pong, tiddlywinks, whatever it is. If they're winning, they're going to come support it. Same way your little towns all across England and Scotland do for their teams. So if we could develop something along those lines that integrates Texas and A&M, because how many living alumni do you have?
About 600,000.
Yeah. A&M has more graduates a year than Rice has living alumni. So if you throw that all, you know, behind that.
And the other sports are doing that. I mean, the Astros every year have a Texas A&M night. I
was, yeah, we're kind of what I'm thinking. Yeah. I mean, why aren't we tapping into all the alumni of these schools and making it benefit your program and the NWSL and the women's
game. And we have an Aggie that's prevalent on the Dash with Shea Groom. Shea Groom is one of the stars.
And we've got to do more of this. These are things that are sitting right
absolutely.
In front of us.
We've had these conversations, and one of the things we've started to build a relationship, you know, we've had a couple of autograph sessions both ways where our women go to a Dash game and sign autographs before the game, and the other way around where we get a couple of players of the Dash come to our games. We've had talks about playing games there, but if you look at college sports, you know, our football team plays Texas Tech on September 4th at NRG. Because they have a big game every year. Our baseball team, there's a tournament every year that's played at Minute Maid Park. There's no reason that we can't continue to build on that. And with the three of us in here all on board, I guarantee we can get some good teams to come in and play
us. You can draw the rest of the state for sure.
We can play doubleheaders back-to-back, boom, where the three of our teams a tournament weekend, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I see college baseball constantly in Major League Baseball stadiums. I think it's just a big missed opportunity. All right, let's talk a little bit more about what's happening now, because you guys are getting pretty quickly back into it, right? When is your you guys all do camps? You have your camps, which are a major part of your programs. So how quickly are you back into preseason now? Because you just finished the season. Now you got the pandemic threw us off. But
so it's funny,
August, right?
It's funny because I think people think our summers are kind of, you know, casual and wearing flip-flops, and it's the busiest time of the year. It's a good crazy, a lot better than last year where nothing was going on. But, you know, so for us, we've all finished some sort of camp setting so far. Tomorrow is probably a travel day for a lot of college coaches heading out to a big event that Dash Youth Group is playing in. The GAL is playing out in Oceanside, California for about a week. And then next week, we go back across the country to Florida for another 8-day event in the Bradenton area, you know, near Sarasota, and then come back. It's probably some more camps for everybody, and then first, I think it's August 2nd is when preseason kicks off for all of us.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so it's a quick turnaround, absolutely.
Especially coming off the season we just had,
exactly.
Which usually is 4 months in the fall, and this year was 10 months that didn't end until May.
So you're jamming your camps in, you're jamming your recruiting in.
Hey, we're happy to be out there. We're happy to be out there. It's you know, you'll look at the feast or famine, and last year being the famine of not being able to be out there and not being able to work with kids in the community, not being able to do all those things, and not having fans really come out and bring the energy to the players. I know all of us are really excited about what this fall looks like it's going to be with full houses and everything else.
Yeah, so when you guys were in the pandemic, we all realized a lot of things about ourselves. Anything that really jumped out to all three of you that might apply a little bit more to coaching or something unique you did during that time period, realizations, whatever?
I'll say this. From what I saw, colleagues around the country and programs around the country, it really stood out, the coaches that really care about their players as people, and the ones that didn't maybe aren't here anymore, retired, resigned, just got out of the sport because the transactional coaches were found out, and the more transformational coaches, and I have no problem saying that because I know the two people next to me and the integrity that comes with them and the people that they are, they care about their players, they care about their programs, and it's more than soccer. And so if I saw anything out of this pandemic, it was that some people that maybe were on the fence, they were forced to, in a good way, to really spend more time treating their players as people and as student athletes, not just commodities, which I saw too often in honesty. And so I think that came to the forefront, and I think that was one of the benefits of this.
Yeah, to echo what Diego's saying, I think it became a relationship-based industry and really put to the forefront of how important that is with your players, because our players are all over the place, whether it's all over the country, all over the world, and we still had to maintain those relationships if we wanted to be successful in the spring as well as we went through the pandemic. And then, beyond that, I think in college athletics, we felt a lot like, hey, I got to be 24/7, that included 8 hours a day in the office, and I think we were able to go home and do a better job from off campus, in our own minds. You still have to be on campus when you're on practice. The kids got to be able to see you and those kind of things. But I do think it changed the job to a great degree. We realized, hey, we can do this from different places and still have even a better relationship with our players coming out of it.
Well, the other thing that I think came out of it from an X's and O's standpoint is the fact that everything slowed down. Our seasons were diminished last year, and then they were stretched to be the whole season. You never knew what was coming around the next corner. But playing one game a week, we've been playing two games a week for
ever
for more than 40 years, 60 years. And sometimes, in the olden days, it was, Friday-Saturday games or Saturday-Sunday games. So playing double games and just grinding. And now last year it was a situation where, no, you can't do that because of all this testing we have to do in between matches. And the ability for us to really kind of dive in and develop our players. I know for us, our team that we were playing with as we were making our run through the NCAA tournament was five freshmen and three sophomores in our lineup. And the main reason that was able to be, besides the fact that they were talented players and I've got a great staff, but we got an extra day or two a week to train. And there was a pause at the start of the season, and we got an extra month to train that team. And we didn't have to grind. We didn't have to go two sessions a day. We went one session a day, focused on quality. Soft tissue injuries disappeared because we weren't grinding as much. And the team became closer because it wasn't a survival test as much as it was a developmental exercise. And that was something that we've talked about. Is there a way for us to bring some of these good things that happened last year in a bad year? Can we learn some of these lessons and bring them forward? So we've talked about trying to stretch our season out. That going two semesters didn't work. because
it's not going to work on the women's side.
It's not.
I don't think it can work on the men's side, to be honest. I know they're pushing for that, but you've seen with MLS making their announcement of a new development league and everything. I think they're going to be competing too much with those college players. And to be honest, on the women's side, they didn't want it.
Right. And on the men, well, just in general, around the country, you're in the spring, you're competing with all these other sports that are in season. Right now, we are a big deal in the fall, and that's the way we need to keep it.
Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for coming out. G. Guerrieri, Texas A&M. G, thank you for making the run down here. Brian Lee with Rice University, thank you so much. And Diego Bocanegra with U of H. Guys, a big thank you for coming in here. A big effort from all you guys, and continue the great work you're doing with college student athletes and these great soccer programs you're running.
Thanks for what you do for building the game down here in Houston. It's great.
All right, round of applause for our three coaches, G. Guerrieri, Brian Lee, Diego Bocanegra. We'll take a break here. It's all brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. Coming up next, Commissioner Don Garber of Major League Soccer.